When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Whispers from the Dark. The Billionaire Escape Plan. Why the ultra-rich are building underground cities. By Raven Vale. There is a particular kind of door you will never see. It does not stand at the entrance of a skyscraper. It is not guarded by velvet ropes. It is not marked on any map the public has access to. It is buried. Beneath fields that stretch to every horizon, with no visible structure above them. Beneath mountains whose granite exteriors give no indication of what has been carved into them. Beneath private estates so vast that helicopters are required to cross them. Behind that door are rooms stocked for decades, water systems that filter continuously, independent of municipal infrastructure, air purification units engineered for nuclear, biological, and chemical contaminants, medical suites with surgical equipment maintained to hospital standards, hydroponic farms producing food under calibrated artificial light, private theaters, wine cellars organized by vintage, fitness facilities designed by the same architects who build resort spas, psychological health rooms with screens that simulate skylines and speakers that play bird song, artificial sunlight cycling on a programmed clock, and silence, the particular engineered silence of a place built to keep the outside world exactly that, outside. Above ground, the world scrolls past its headlines. Economic tension, political unrest, climate instability, cyber warfare, artificial intelligence accelerating faster than anyone can govern it. Below ground, plans are already in motion. The ultra-rich are building survival architecture at a scale history has no precedent for. Luxury bunkers, private islands with completely independent infrastructure, self-sustaining underground compounds large enough to house families, personal staff, security personnel, and the specialists required to maintain the systems keeping everyone alive and sane. The question is not whether this is happening. It is. The question is why. What do they know that we don't? Are they preparing for a specific collapse? Are they responding rationally to documented risks? Or is fear simply the most expensive commodity on Earth? This is Whispers from the Dark. The Return of the Fortress. Throughout history, power has always built walls. The medieval castle was not merely a residence, it was a declaration, an architectural statement that the people inside had the resources, the foresight, and the will to survive whatever arrived at the gate. Mountain monasteries carved into cliff faces, desert fortresses positioned at the convergence of trade routes, walled cities within cities, where the innermost ring was always reserved for those whose survival the society deemed most essential. When uncertainty rises, the powerful retreat into architecture. Architecture becomes armor. Today, the armor is modernized. Former missile silos in the American Midwest, structures built to survive nuclear war and abandoned when the Cold War ended, have been purchased and converted into luxury survival condominiums. The engineering that once protected nuclear warheads now protects residents who paid millions for a private unit behind reinforced concrete walls designed to absorb a nearby blast. Deep underground complexes feature biometric entry systems, private swimming pools, climbing walls, and spaces designed by architects whose previous projects were five-star hotels. The aesthetic is not military. It is resort. Remote estates in New Zealand have attracted attention when their strategic rationale, geographic isolation, political stability, distance from likely conflict zones, became public knowledge. Silicon Valley executives have purchased land in regions identified by analysts as geopolitically stable. This is documented. It appears in property records, planning applications, and the occasional candid interview. It has been reported in financial publications, in technology journalism, and in the kind of long investigative features that take months to report because the subjects would rather not be found. Billionaires discuss what they call resilience planning. They use corporate language. Preparation, insurance, continuity of operations. Beneath the vocabulary lies something older and simpler. Fear. The psychology of extreme preparation. Why would someone worth billions feel compelled to build an underground fortress stocked for a decade of autonomous survival? Because extreme wealth does not eliminate vulnerability. It amplifies awareness of it. Those at the top see information the public does not. They fund think tanks modeling geopolitical scenarios years in advance. They retain analysts whose job is to identify not what is likely to happen, but what would be catastrophic if it did. They have access to climate modeling data in its full, unfiltered complexity. Some receive intelligence briefings through networks that cross the lines between private and governmental in ways that are not publicly disclosed. When your information environment is defined by people whose job is to identify tail risks, your perception of the world changes. The ultra-rich think in terms of asymmetry. Low probability, combined with catastrophic consequence, produces a category of risk that rational actors with sufficient resources are almost compelled to hedge against. Not because they expect it, but because the cost of the hedge is trivial relative to their wealth, and being wrong without one is unimaginable. Pandemic emergence from novel pathogens in densely connected global populations, populations that move between continents in hours, carrying biological material that a previous era would have contained to a single region. Cyber grid collapse that disables power, water, and communication infrastructure across large geographic areas simultaneously. Civil unrest escalating past the containment capacity of existing systems, not the ordinary civil unrest of protest, but the kind that emerges when foundational economic promises fail for enough people at the same time. Supply chain failures cascading through interdependent networks whose complexity is not visible until a single point of failure propagates through every downstream dependency. AI development outpacing governance. Nuclear escalation between powers whose domestic pressures override rational deterrence. Climate-driven migration at scales that overwhelm the absorptive capacity of receiving regions and destabilize the political systems trying to manage the pressure. To most people, these are headlines. To people with resources, and the analysts those resources buy, they are scenarios. Modeled, probability-weighted, strategy-generating scenarios. And scenarios invite preparation. The bunker is the preparation made physical. Luxury beneath the earth. The survival bunker of popular imagination is a concrete room with cots and canned goods. That is not what is being built. Modern elite survival facilities are architectural projects of genuine sophistication, designed by firms applying the same standards underground that they apply to luxury residential work above it. Hydroponic farming systems produce vegetables, herbs, and fruits year-round under full-spectrum artificial lighting. The farms are designed not just for nutrition, but for the psychological value of living, growing things in a sealed environment that would otherwise feel entirely inert. Medical facilities are equipped for surgery, chronic condition management, and emergencies that above ground would require a hospital. Pharmaceutical stockpiles are maintained with expiration management, ensuring medications remain effective. Across the years, a facility might need to sustain itself. Fitness infrastructure, rock climbing walls, pools, sports courts, appears not as indulgence, but as operational necessity. Bodies confined without movement deteriorate. Minds confined without stimulation destabilize. The physical design of the facility keeps both functional under conditions that, without that design, would cause both to fail. Then there are the psychological details. Screens that simulate windows, displaying natural landscapes, cycling through realistic lighting, changes across a 24-hour period, providing the circadian rhythm cues human biology requires, and that a sealed underground space cannot supply naturally, not a single static image. A living simulation, updated in real time, moving from the blue-gray of early morning through the warmth of midday into the orange depth of evening, matching the light profile of whatever latitude the occupant prefers. Soundscapes of birdsong, wind, and rainfall. Architectural proportions designed in consultation with behavioral psychologists to reduce the subjective experience of confinement. Spaces for meditation, art, prayer. This is survival engineered not merely to preserve biological function, but to preserve what the people commissioning it consider worth preserving. Their quality of life, their sense of themselves. Whether that is admirable resourcefulness or a revealing indicator of priorities is a question worth sitting with. What do they know? This is the question the existence of elite bunkers inevitably generates in everyone who learns about them. What do they know that we don't? Is there a briefing, a data set, a classified assessment circulating among the world's wealthiest that establishes a specific timeline for a specific catastrophe? Is the construction of these facilities a response to knowledge rather than anxiety? The answer, as best as available evidence allows, probably not in the way the question implies. There is no confirmed master secret, no single document establishing a countdown to a known event withheld from the public and shared exclusively among the ultra-wealthy. The people building these facilities do not appear to be acting on information the rest of us would recognize as a smoking gun. What they appear to be acting on is more diffuse, and in some ways more unsettling. A clear-eyed assessment of how fragile the systems sustaining modern civilization actually are, combined with the resources to respond to that assessment, and the rationality to conclude that responding is obviously preferable to not. Consider the logic from inside their position. A person with sufficient wealth maintains diversified assets across multiple asset classes, currencies, and jurisdictions. Not because they expect any single system to collapse, but because diversification is how rational actors manage complex risk. They carry insurance on properties they have no reason to believe will suffer a covered loss, because the asymmetry between the premium and an uninsured catastrophe makes the purchase rational regardless of probability. They maintain redundant communication, backup power, and business continuity plans, because the cost of redundancy is low, and the cost of being without it, when it matters, is high. The bunker, in this framing, is simply the ultimate redundancy. But the optics do not resolve into comfortable rationality, because when the people with the most information and the most resources prepare quietly and extensively for scenarios the rest of the world is experiencing without preparation, the perception that they know something, that there is a reason behind the construction that is not being shared, is nearly impossible to suppress. And perception, in matters of social trust, is not separate from reality. It is part of it. Private islands and digital fortresses. Not all escape plans go underground. Some go offshore. Private islands represent the purest form of territorial sovereignty available to a private individual. You control entry, you control infrastructure, you determine the rules. No neighbors, no zoning boards, no social contracts beyond the ones you choose to honor. In an era of growing concern about the stability of nation-states, private islands have acquired a new dimension beyond luxury. Independent solar grids generating power without connection to a utility that could fail. Desalination systems producing fresh water from the surrounding ocean, regardless of what happens on the mainland. Satellite communication bypassing terrestrial networks, fuel storage sustaining generators for extended periods, agricultural land managed to produce a meaningful portion of the food the island's inhabitants require. The island in this configuration is not a vacation home. It is a jurisdiction, a self-contained unit capable of sustaining itself independently of the mainland systems surrounding it. The same engineering principles that allow Antarctic research stations to operate independently for months applied to a setting with considerably more resources. Others invest in fortified continental estates, properties with private security teams operating at a professional level, rivaling small military units, underground garages, redundant communication infrastructure, and perimeter systems sophisticated enough to detect threats before they reach the main structure. But a third category of fortress is emerging alongside the physical ones. The digital fortress. Cybersecurity vaults protecting financial assets and personal data from attacks that have already compromised hospitals, power utilities, and government agencies. Encrypted communication networks operating independently of public internet infrastructure. Data redundancy storing critical information across multiple secure jurisdictions, so no single point of failure causes catastrophic loss. In an era where a coordinated cyber attack could disable power grids and disrupt banking simultaneously, the digital bunker is not a supplement to the physical one. It is an equal partner. Survival is no longer only about food, water, and air. It is about information, connectivity, the ability to coordinate and transact when the systems everyone else depends on have stopped functioning. The most sophisticated escape plans recognize this, and they build accordingly. Fear as a commodity. There is another dimension easy to overlook when focusing on individual billionaires and their psychology. Fear sells. The luxury bunker industry is an industry. It has marketing departments, sales teams, and customer testimonials. It has competitors differentiating their products on specifications and amenities, the way automakers differentiate on horsepower and interior features. It has trade publications and the kind of aspirational content that makes people who don't yet own a bunker feel that the people who do are simply more prepared and more serious. The companies building and selling elite survival facilities market exclusivity as a feature. They market prestige. The bunker not merely as a survival tool, but as evidence of sophisticated thinking, of an owner whose planning horizon extends beyond the next quarter. The wealthy have always competed through visible assets, yachts, private jets, skyscrapers, art collections. Now resilience becomes status. The comprehensiveness of your survival architecture signals foresight. Its sophistication signals resources. Fear becomes an industry. Security consultants specializing in ultra-high net worth threat environments. Crisis forecasters translating scenarios into preparation recommendations. Subterranean architects developing the specialized engineering expertise that functional underground construction requires. These sectors profit from sustained anticipation. Their growth depends on the persistent belief that preparation is necessary and that insufficient preparation has severe consequences, which means they have a structural interest in the anxiety that drives demand for their services. So we must ask, are billionaires responding to real, documented risk? Or are they also participating in a self-reinforcing ecosystem of anxiety? One where preparation infrastructure creates demand for more preparation infrastructure, and the accumulation of that infrastructure among the ultra-wealthy creates a norm that no one in that world wants to be seen opting out of? The answer is almost certainly both. The risks are real. The anxiety is real. The industry profiting from both is also real. And human beings, with all the rationality and irrationality that entails, do what they have always done when they have resources and uncertainty in the same moment. They build. The social contract. There is a tension beneath the concrete that does not resolve neatly into economics or psychology. The social contract rests on a foundational assumption: shared fate. The idea that in genuine crisis, we are in it together. That the interests of the powerful and the interests of the general population are, at some fundamental level, aligned. That leaders do not have exits, the people they lead do not have. Bunker culture suggests something different. A lifeboat mentality. The existence of a class of people for whom the social contract is not a mutual commitment, but a contingent arrangement, maintained while convenient and abandoned when costs become too high. The exit strategy is the philosophical problem. If the most powerful people in a society plan, quietly and comprehensively, to retreat from the surface world during sufficient instability, while the general population has no equivalent option and no knowledge that the option exists, then the relationship between that class and the society they occupy is fundamentally different from what the language of citizenship and shared fate implies. The phrase shared fate is doing enormous work in the social contract. It means, at its core, that we are all in the same boat. That the people making decisions about the boat's direction are subject to the same consequences as the people who must live with those decisions. That accountability is enforced, ultimately, by the fact that the decision maker cannot simply leave when the consequences arrive. Bunker culture withdraws from that accountability. It creates a class of people who can make decisions about the boat's direction with the quiet knowledge that they have another boat ready, a private one, below the waterline, stocked and sealed and waiting. Even if the plan is never executed, even if the bunkers stand empty for decades, the existence of the plan matters. It reveals how those who built it understand their relationship to everyone around them. And when this becomes known, as it inevitably does, trust erodes. Citizens who believe elites are preparing to abandon the surface world become less cooperative with the institutions those elites control, less willing to contribute to systems they believe will not protect them in return, more susceptible to narratives that explain their situation in terms of betrayal rather than shared risk. Resentment, once it reaches a certain temperature, destabilizes systems faster than almost any external threat. The social contract is not merely broken by catastrophe. It is broken by the demonstrated belief that catastrophe is coming, and that not everyone's survival has been planned for equally. Historical parallels. This is not the first time the powerful have built separate survival architectures, while the general population navigated shared risk with shared resources. During the Cold War, governments maintained elaborate continuity systems. Command bunkers preserved leadership through hypothetical nuclear exchanges. The people who would govern the post-nuclear world had designated places to go. The population they would govern did not. Private versions existed alongside governmental ones, the wealthy building or purchasing fallout shelters, while everyone else read civil defense pamphlets. The disparity was noted. The friction was real. During plague eras, the pattern was older and more consistent. Nobility retreated to countryside estates when epidemic disease moved through cities. The distances were not coincidental. They were executing exit strategies whose effectiveness depended entirely on their ability to leave when others could not. During revolutions, elites fled capitals when the social order shifted past the point where their position within it provided more protection than their absence from it. The impulse is identical across all of these moments. What is different is the technology. Modern engineering allows genuinely self-contained underground ecosystems sustaining human life comfortably for years without surface infrastructure. Artificial intelligence manages resource allocation with a precision no human operational team could match. Automation reduces the human labor required to maintain a facility, allowing a smaller, more trusted group to sustain the environment without the security complications that come with a large staff. The historical escape was always intended to be temporary. The option now being built is, in principle, permanent. The philosophical question this raises is not comfortable. Is survival a collective endeavor? Or is it something that individuals, given sufficient resources, are entitled to pursue independently, regardless of what their survival means for everyone they leave behind? Collapse or control? Some speculate that the billionaires building bunkers are not merely preparing for collapse, they are anticipating it. Some fraction of that speculation goes further, suggesting the people best positioned to prevent certain kinds of collapse have chosen instead to prepare for them, because the post-collapse world may offer opportunities the current one does not. There is little credible evidence supporting the most extreme versions of this theory. What the evidence does support is something disturbing in a different and perhaps more important way: asymmetric information and asymmetric preparation. The people building these facilities understand, with clarity that comes from paying significant money for sophisticated analysis, exactly how fragile the systems sustaining modern civilization are. Global supply chains moving essential goods across dozens of jurisdictions, dependent on stable governments, functioning ports, and predictable demand. Power grids whose cyber vulnerabilities have been documented by security researchers and demonstrated by actual attacks, and whose repair after a major coordinated strike would take months. Financial markets that depend on confidence, and that have demonstrated how rapidly confidence evaporates when the right trigger appears. These are not manufactured anxieties. They are real fragilities identified through real work. The question is what you do with that knowledge. If you have resources to prepare privately, do you bear any responsibility to use some portion of those resources to reduce the probability of the scenarios you are preparing for? Or is preparation simply a rational individual response to systemic risk? The billionaires building bunkers are not, in most cases, doing nothing to address systemic fragility. Many fund research, policy work, and technological development aimed at the very problems their survival facilities are designed to protect against. But they are also building the bunkers, and the bunkers tell a story about which outcome they consider more likely to need preparing for. The psychology of escape. There is something symbolic about going underground, descending, retreating from light, exchanging the open sky for concrete ceilings and filtered air and the particular quality of silence that exists below the surface of things. The subconscious reads it as regression. Not in the clinical sense, not as pathology, but in the oldest sense. A return to something prior to all the architecture and ambition and complexity that defines modern life. A return to the cave, to the primal shelter that predates civilization by hundreds of thousands of years, that the human body still recognizes as protection even when the mind knows it is standing in a room that was engineered by architects, equipped by contractors, and stocked by logistics companies using just-in-time inventory systems. When technology reaches its furthest edge, when the digital and the biological are being redesigned simultaneously, and the rate of change exceeds anyone's ability to fully comprehend it, humans return to stone. This is the paradox that sits at the center of the billionaire bunker phenomenon, and that makes it more philosophically interesting than a simple story about fear. The same people commissioning these underground facilities are, in many cases, the same people funding the technological development that is generating the uncertainty they are preparing for. The artificial intelligence researchers whose work is reshaping labor markets and decision-making systems are, in some cases, the same people quietly purchasing New Zealand farmland. The venture capitalists funding companies that are disrupting the stability of established industries are, in some cases, the same people installing biometric security on steel doors buried under their estates. Progress and retreat existing simultaneously in the same person. Perhaps the bunker is not primarily a sign of expected doom. Perhaps it is a psychological anchor, a felt sense of control in a world where the rate of change has exceeded the human nervous system's ability to process. A place that does not update. A room that will be the same tomorrow as it is today. A space that promises, in the language of architecture rather than words, that not everything is in flux, and that, whatever else it is, may be the most honest thing about the whole enterprise. We all want somewhere to stand that will not move beneath us. The ultra-rich simply have the resources to build one. If nothing happens. Consider the quieter ending to this story. Not the dramatic one, not the grid going dark and the sirens and the doors sealing and the screens switching on and the hydroponic lights cycling to their first simulated dawn. The quieter one, in which the scenarios being prepared for do not materialize, or materialize in attenuated forms that existing systems prove adequate to handle, or are averted by exactly the kinds of collective human ingenuity and institutional resilience that the bunker builders seem to have concluded cannot be counted on, in which the facilities stand empty for decades, maintained on rolling contracts by caretaker staff who replenish water filters and rotate pharmaceutical stocks and test air systems that never need to activate, toured occasionally by their owners who experience a complicated mixture of relief that the investment is unnecessary and unease about the amount of capital tied up in infrastructure serving no current purpose. What do unused bunkers mean? They become, in the first instance, expensive real estate, specialized facilities that are difficult to repurpose, difficult to sell, and expensive to maintain. They become reminders of a particular period of anxiety that, in retrospect, perhaps produced more fear than the actual risks warranted. But they reveal something more durable than the specific fears that produced them. They reveal that those with the most to lose prepared the most intensely. Not necessarily because they expected disaster tomorrow, but because the calculation was simple and rational and, from within their position, almost irresistible. If you can eliminate a category of risk at a cost that is trivial relative to your resources, and the consequence of encountering that risk without having prepared is unimaginable, then you prepare. Not out of certainty, not out of secret knowledge, out of the particular logic that attends extreme wealth and its relationship to uncertainty. Even unused, the bunker says something true about its builder. It says, "I took seriously the possibility that the world as I have known it could change faster than any existing system could absorb." It says, "I believed my survival, and the survival of the people I chose to bring with me, was worth extraordinary investment to secure." And perhaps most quietly, most revealingly, it says, "I was not certain that the society I have benefited from, and profited from, and in many cases helped to build, would be capable of protecting me when protecting me became difficult." That last sentence is where the social contract begins to fray, regardless of whether the doors ever close. The final question. Imagine the door closing, the steel ceiling with a hydraulic hiss that is quieter than you expected, the air systems engaging, a low, steady hum that you will eventually stop noticing, or so the behavioral psychologists who consulted on the design have promised. The screen switching on, cycling through a sunrise over a coastline you selected from a catalogue of options. Outside, the world shifts. Inside, stability persists. Is that safety? Or is it something more like exile? Chosen, voluntary, self-inflicted exile from the world that produced you, that formed you, that gave you the opportunities you converted into the wealth that paid for the door now sealed behind you. Survival architecture protects the body. But what does confinement, even beautifully designed, psychologically optimized, architecturally sophisticated confinement, do to the soul? Human beings evolved in community. In the presence of other people, they had not screened and selected and brought below the surface. In environments they did not control, could not predict, and could not adjust by filing a request with the facility management system. In weather they did not choose. In social situations whose outcomes could not be managed by a security team operating on a carefully vetted access list. We evolved to be interrupted, to be surprised, to encounter people and situations we would not have engineered for ourselves, and to be changed, sometimes painfully, sometimes wonderfully, by those encounters. The bunker can be made comfortable. It can be made beautiful. Its atmospheric composition can be calibrated to optimal oxygen levels, and its lighting can cycle through a simulated day that mirrors the circadian rhythms the occupants would experience if they were somewhere they had chosen freely. But it cannot replicate the fundamental experience of being embedded in a world you did not build and cannot fully control. And that experience, vulnerable, unmanageable, inescapably shared, may be more essential to human flourishing than any survival facility can substitute for. Perhaps the true escape plan is not about apocalypse. Perhaps it is about control, the desire to outmaneuver fate itself, to remove from the equation the one variable that no amount of wealth has ever reliably managed: uncertainty. The uncertainty of living in a world with other people. The uncertainty of depending on systems you did not build and cannot repair. The uncertainty of a future that has not asked your permission. Wealth has never fully resolved that uncertainty. The bunker is the latest attempt. The ultra-rich are building underground cities. That much is no longer in question. Whether they expect collapse or simply fear it. Whether they are rational actors executing the logical conclusion of asymmetric risk analysis, or wealthy human beings doing what all human beings do when they sense the ground shifting beneath them, is harder to know. Perhaps unknowable from the outside, perhaps not entirely clear to the people inside the decision either. But history teaches something consistent. When power feels genuine uncertainty, it fortifies. When the future feels unstable, it digs deep. When wealth seeks permanence in an impermanent world, it builds. And increasingly, it builds beneath the surface, where the things that cannot be seen cannot be easily threatened, and where the chaos of the world above becomes someone else's problem to manage. The question for the rest of us is not whether the bunkers exist. The satellite images confirm them. The planning applications establish their scale. The interviews, candid and otherwise, describe their purpose. The question is what their existence says about the civilization that produced them, about the trust, or its absence, between those who hold the most resources and those who hold the most exposure to the risks those resources are being used to escape. About what we share, genuinely and practically, when we say we share a society. About whether the social contract is a mutual commitment or a contingent arrangement that the most powerful reserve the right to exit when the terms become inconvenient. These are not comfortable questions. They do not have tidy answers. They sit in the same unresolved space as most of the questions that matter most about how human beings organize their collective lives. But they are worth asking, because the door is there. Somewhere beneath the surface of the world you move through every day, beneath the roads you drive and the buildings you enter and the institutions you depend on, behind steel and concrete and engineered silence, there is a room that was built by people with the resources to imagine a future without you in it, without most of us in it. A future they have decided is worth planning for, even if they hope it never arrives. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and somewhere beneath your feet, plans are already in place. Whether they are ever needed is a story still being written. But the fact that they exist? That story is already told. And it began long before any of us thought to ask the question.